businesses have historically been complacent, really, about cyber risk and cybersecurity. And I think over the past few years, there's almost been a resignation about the inevitability of cyber attacks.
Hello, and welcome to Identity Today, your go-to for what's what on all things security, digital identity, and biometrics. I'm your host, Blair Crawford. Today in the show, I'm joined by Lisa Fitzgerald, partner at Lander & Rogers. The topic of focus today is law and its impact on emerging tech. I really hope you enjoy the chat.
I think it might be worthwhile to take 1 minute to discuss security.
Welcome to the show, Lisa. Great to have you on today.
Thanks, Blair. Thank you for having me.
So, before we get stuck into the topic, it'd be great to get a bit of background to you. Introduce yourself, if you don't mind.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a corporate partner with law firm Lander & Rogers, which is a national law firm here in Australia. I specialise in technology, media, telecommunications, intellectual property rights and privacy, and have a particular interest in everything emerging tech. Such an exciting space to work in at the moment. And I also advise companies in relation to cybersecurity.
So today we're going to be talking about the law and its impact on new and emerging technologies. So where I want to start is, for the first time ever, we saw that the federal court has delivered a ruling on cyber practices in financial services. And it's kind of, in doing that, they've kind of elevated it to become more of a critical business issue. So I mean, what does that mean for businesses in the finance sector, but I suppose even more broadly speaking, outside of the finance sector?
It's a great topic to talk about at the moment. The decision is important for a couple of reasons. It's the first successful enforcement action brought by one of Australia's corporate regulators, ASIC, which is the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, and the federal court's first decision dealing expressly with cyber security practices in connection with an Australian financial services licence. But I think we can take away some lessons more broadly for corporates across Australia from the decision. It also represents a call to action to Australian corporates to do more when it comes to building and maintaining cybersecurity practices. Now, this is an action brought by one of Australia's corporate regulators, ASIC, but it's important to remember that other regulators exist that are watching over corporates as well, and that's due to the hybrid nature of our regulatory landscape. And so we have APRA, ASIC, the ACCC, the OAIC, which is the privacy regulator, all watching over corporate Australia in relation to their cyber practices, and, for example, how they relate to financial services obligations. So ASIC is watching under Section 912A of the Corporations Act. APRA is watching under CPS 234 and BEAR under the Banking Act. The OAIC is watching for privacy and credit reporting practices under the Privacy Act and so on. So what does this mean for businesses today? Well, I think it really just means that no business is going to be immune from potential investigations, audits or penalties in relation to their practices. Post the Hayne Royal Commission, enforcement action is likely to be on the rise across all of those regulators I've mentioned. And the biggest risk, of course, is multi-million dollar fines and reputational damage. So to the extent that any directors are also involved in a breach of their director's duties, there could be personal liability as well. And just to recap, the scale of the exposure across a multitude of regulatory regimes is potentially massive. And in the case of financial penalties, Section 912 of the Corporations Act, which was invoked in the RI decision, the maximum penalty is the greater of $11.1 million, or three times the benefit obtained from the breach, or 10% of annual domestic turnover capped at 2.5 million penalty units, which translates to $555 million. So it's the sort of hit that can put businesses out of business and something that needs to be factored into their everyday based on that risk alone.
Just on that, what was the actual enforcement for that case then where the federal court ruled against that financial services company?
Well, in this particular case, there weren't actually any pecuniary penalties imposed because there was a settlement in which those penalties were abandoned by ASIC. But I think it goes to show that regulators are flexing the muscle. They're taking enforcement action, and settlements won't be the outcome for every case. Here it may have been due to the timeframes involved and changes in legislation that occurred over the relevant period of time, which saw nine different cyber incidents, but certainly I wouldn't be taking any comfort that that's going to be the outcome for everybody going forward.
So, yeah, I mean, I agree that everyone should be paying attention to that, because it may have been a warning. And as you said there, like flexing the muscles to say, hey, we're looking at this more seriously now. And you referenced there that there were 9 different controls or incidents that were identified throughout that ruling. Specifically called out was a weakness associated with passwords and the fact that businesses aren't taking cyber risk seriously enough. What do you think that's said historically about the importance of cybersecurity and regulation, and then I suppose how it now needs to apply?
It's a great question, Blair. I think the biggest message from the decision is really that businesses have historically been complacent, really, about cyber risk and cybersecurity. And I think over the past few years, there's almost been a resignation about the inevitability of cyber attacks. And so a reactive approach has been adopted by a lot of businesses. You know, it's a let's wait and see what happens and then we'll deal with it. We've got our incident response plan. That's what we need to do. We'll work to mitigate the impact. And I think the problem with that approach is that when a cyber attack does happen, the scale of inadequacies can be quite spectacular. And it's the sort of thing that will not only drain consumer and customer confidence, but it could also impact share price and all sorts of other value metrics when it comes to the consequences of a cyber attack. And so regulatory action can also be taken as well. So I think that's probably one of the key messages. Being reactive is not going to cut it anymore. And also there's a tendency to think of cyber as the IT department's domain and simply involves technical measures to reduce risk without much attention given to the human error factor. And I think passwords really do fall within that category, or at least we associate passwords with human error. And what can you do if human error is inevitable? But I actually think that we need to ask, is that the case? There seems to be an opportunity to undertake or look into studies of why password failures are so common. And I know in my own life, passwords are a nightmare to manage. I know there are apps out there to help me where I can store the passwords, but I'm not supposed to store them. And anyway, you sort of resort quite often to resetting your password every single time you open an app. And it's not only an inconvenience and frustrating, but it's also inefficient when it comes to doing business. So I think there's an opportunity for businesses to think more about how they architect their cybersecurity structure. And perhaps there's a real opportunity to do things a bit differently.
Are you seeing companies then looking at how to consider cyber risk more intrinsically in their operating model?
To be honest, I haven't really seen that, but I think there's a massive need for it, which is where independent cyber experts are likely to play a role, which the RI advice decision refers to as being required to ensure adequate cybersecurity practices. But the pressure will be on those guys to really work out how to build a program of uplift that's going to be future-proof. And as we all know, cyber risk is evolving continually. It doesn't stay the same. It's not static. So I think that cybersecurity requires innovative solutions and thinking going forward. It's going to be a fascinating space to watch and to see how the sector develops in response to a decision like this.
So just moving on from cyber for a moment, you've said that after that ruling, anything tech-related will be closely watched from a regulator perspective, and that it's only a matter of time before regulators look into things like blockchain and digital assets. What are you seeing there? What's going on?
The main thing really to be aware of at the moment is that businesses should be on high alert. New technologies are being developed pretty enthusiastically, and we can see it across lots of different sectors already. Lots of activity within the investment funds and crypto space. Other sorts of digital assets like non-fungible tokens are also being adopted at pace in all sorts of sectors, from sport to design and fashion, right through to gaming. And so I think it's an area that regulators are going to start to really crack down on simply because there is risk involved. It's an immature, volatile market. There's a tendency to think that automated transactions that blockchain technology gives effect to sit above the law. They have their own self-contained rules, so they sit outside any current regulatory environment and legal structures. But in fact, that's not the case. And I think we're all on notice that that's not the case. Crypto and digital assets are an asset class that even factor into divorce proceedings. So this is something that's part of our reality now. And to dismiss the regulatory risk around that rapid adoption of new technology would be a mistake.
You talked in an article which you published recently, you coined this phrase of split chain as a concept, and it was around strengthening the commercialization prospects of blockchain. Can you just explain what split chain is and what you were talking about there?
So split chain is a concept designed to cure the misconception that blockchain exists outside or above the law. And it's really something that I'm using to demonstrate how blockchain use cases can be strengthened if you bring an inquiring legal mind to that commercialization process. So I use the idea of a double helix when it comes to analyzing different blockchain use cases and objectives to help distill not only the technological rules that might apply to automated transaction, but also the legal rules that might apply to fortify that blockchain use case. So it's something like blockchain itself, conceptually complex, but that in and of itself needn't be the reason we approach it with a non-inquiring mind. I think the beauty of a split chain analysis is to see how the law and technology can work together in a way that will achieve successful commercialization, as opposed to just sort of adopting new technology blindly and hoping for the best and then sort of it being your downfall.
So is that, I mean, as an example of that, is that looking at a smart contract and making sure it just doesn't exist as a capability that sits within a blockchain, but a smart contract can be integrated into general legal frameworks, which allow it to then be used across, you know, corporations, for example? Is that what we're thinking here?
Yeah, that's right. So just to get a little bit theoretical, smart contract, despite the name, is not a legal contract. It doesn't have the usual characteristics of contract formation. Smart contracts are purely about automating transactions. Smart legal contracts, on the other hand, are not purely code-based, but translatable into natural language. So although certain elements of a contract can be automated, having a complete English or natural language version of that process is going to be important to understand it. It's not that we can all code and understand how that can be translated into a contract at all, but having a natural contract is going to be important, particularly when it comes to enforcement and, again, you know, when it comes to a court or a judge being called to understand what the rights of the parties are in that context and who might need the benefit of a remedy, a contractual remedy in the event of a dispute. So I think just because things can be automated using blockchain transactions doesn't mean that legal liabilities or remedies won't apply in that context. And so legal contracts still have a critical role to play.
You got me thinking now about smart legal contracts. I mean, clearly in a normal contract or traditional type contract, there's signatories and there's some sort of traceability or attribution to who signed and executed a contract. But how is the law and how is a judge when you need to remediate an issue? How do you actually make sure that the person that entered into a smart legal contract was the actual person who was authorised to do so? Is there some sort of framework or a guideline right now?
Yeah, there's not really. And in fact, it's something that I'm working on with my law firm and a few legal technologists to try and solve. We're actually in the process of creating an NFT builder to help anyone who wants to launch an NFT project in a way that ensures those legal protections exist. And we'll be able to do that with a very simple tick box approach to select the terms and conditions you want to apply to the project and also have some sort of verification method in relation to the contracting parties.
Just the last question in this, if you know the answer to, but are there any industries or examples of use cases which are quickly adopting the idea of a smart legal contract? Is it notable who's actually doing it in day-to-day practice?
Yes, certainly. I have corporate clients who are adopting smart legal contracts, but mostly for very simple, straightforward transactions that don't need negotiation or have a need for discretionary type concepts like reasonable endeavours, for example, that lawyers love to build into commercial agreements. But yeah, we're definitely seeing use cases for simple payment transactions, for example. But again, quite often it would just be the agreed method of performing certain transactions as opposed to representing the whole relationship between the parties.
Okay, so that gives a good perspective on the difference between traditional contracts and the smart legal contracts. You mentioned there, though, about NFT builders. that help solve problems? What exactly is an NFT builder in the context of what we're discussing right now? I'd love to hear a bit more about that.
NFT builders will enable a smart legal contract to be put together to accompany an NFT, so to bring certainty to the trading of that NFT and any other rights that come with it. At the moment, very rarely do you see creative NFTs, for example, like the CryptoPunk variety of NFTs, made available with terms and conditions or terms and conditions that you can find. So you visit a website, you see a graphic you like, you have an option to connect your wallet and mint the NFT onto a blockchain, and from there you can sell it to others. But there's often a misconception around what you're actually buying and trading when it comes to creative NFTs. Are you buying the artwork, or you've just been granted a license, and what does that license allow you to do? So an NFT builder will help solve some of those issues around NFTs and any rights that might be associated with that NFT. And so the idea is that they will move together as they're traded. So when an NFT is sold on a blockchain, the person who's buying it will know exactly who they're buying it from and what they're buying. And so one of the biggest risk factors in the context of creative NFTs is IP infringement, so intellectual property rights infringement. If the creator of the NFT is not really the creator at all, but has ripped off someone else's artwork, then the next person who buys it on and sells it on blockchain will also be involved in copyright infringement, like it or not, and could be liable to pay the original creator damages in the form of an account of profits. So our NFT builder will attempt to bring some provenance to this process.
So if I understand that correctly, if right now as it stands, if someone was to steal your Bored Ape or your CryptoPunks, it's pretty hard to remediate any of that as an issue. But if we were to look forward and we were to apply or be able to bind a smart contract which had legal principles which were recognized in a traditional legal framework with the actual intellectual property itself, it'd be hard to then unbind those if there was any issue down the line, which gives the owner and the an ability to, I suppose, try and enforce their intellectual rights or intellectual property rights if anything was to happen, if it was to be stolen or if it to be misused or whatever it is. Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think verification layers are needed to give this space strength and reliability and to inspire confidence and trust to engage with it. That's the biggest problem that needs to be solved. Not only the transaction itself being verified by a network of peer-to-peer computers, but actually the origin of that information and the various stakeholders or people involved in creating it, for example, and what rights they are retaining or selling. So I think that sort of fractionalization of exploitation opportunities that arise out of this process could be really effectively managed using a more extensive verification process.
So just talk about the change of government for a moment, where it may have put the blockchain regulation, intellectual property, smart contract piece into a state of flux until we get some clarity on what they might want to do. Conversely, we've now got a cybersecurity minister in Claire O'Neill. So do you think from your perspective that having cybersecurity recognized at that level in government may actually go very, you know, to the beginning of our conversation, people should be even more on watch in terms of what might happen over the next couple of years in terms of expectation and obligation around protecting data, people, businesses, etc.?
Absolutely. I think it's a show of just how seriously the government is taking cybersecurity, and it's really a recognition of how fundamental technology and data is to doing business. So I think it's very symbolic indeed.
Thank you very much for your time today, Lisa. Looking forward to having you back on the show.
Thank you, Blair. It's been a pleasure.
That's all we have time for this week in Identity Today with me, Blair Crawford. I'd like to say a big thank you to our guest, Lisa, as well as a big thank you to you, our listeners. If you want to know more about what we do at Daltrey, head to daltrey.com.